And good morning. It's Monday morning. My name is Beth Pike, and welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. On today's edition of Jaws of Justice, our host Melvin Merritt is going to be talking with Captain Brad Deichler, and he is with the Kansas City Police Department's Crisis Intervention Team. And he's going to tell us about how they help officers who are dealing with the traumas that they experience on the job. And then in the second half of the show, our host will be Richard Tripp, and he is going to talk with retired pastor Ron Brooks about his time helping the homeless folks that come to the Grand Avenue Temple, and basically what drew him to this ministry, and if retirement has really changed much for him. So stay with us for the second half of the show, and be sure to check out our calendar of events that comes in the middle of the show. And then at the end, we'll have the 420 Drug Wars. But now it's going to be Melvin and his guest, Brad Deichler. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to a live edition of Jaws of Justice. I'm your host, Melvin Merritt. In the studio with me is Captain Brad Deichler. He is
the commander of Employment Crisis Intervention Team. Stay tuned right here on KKFI 90.1 FM. And I'd like to take this time and welcome Captain Deichler.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Okay. I work with the Human Resources Division for KCPD, and I am working inside the employment unit. And what we do there is we're recruiting employees, both law enforcement and civilian positions, and we'll process the employees and then work on getting them through the process and get them hired to work as police officers or civilian employees.
That's interesting. Now, we were talking before we went on air, and we was talking about officers being traumatically, you know, say, for instance, seeing something that is very traumatic to them. Give us some of the reasons what would be that, you know, for them to be very traumatic.
Melvin,
traumatized, actually.
Okay. One of the things, Melvin, that we're trying to focus on with our secondary trauma training, and we've trained a group of about 40 police officers and civilians, we're recognizing that when you work in emergency services, particularly law enforcement, whether you're a police officer or a civilian employee, you can be exposed to situations that might cause you to, over time, become stressed, suffer trauma. So if you're making critical calls, whether it's seeing a dead body, whether you're working in arson, whether you're simply talking to a burglary victim, over time you carry a lot of those experiences with you. They may not have happened to you, but the fact of it is because you empathize with the person that you're speaking to, you start to carry that stress. That's why we call it secondary trauma. It's not the trauma that you personally necessarily experienced, but you're vicariously experiencing that trauma. And I can think of a lot of calls in the last 25 years that I've made that I can remember as clearly as something that happened this morning, because they tend to stick with you.
Mm. So how do you recognize some of these things that the officers is being, I should say, for lack of a better word, being on the job? And all of a sudden you spot them, and then how do you recognize this?
That's a good question, and that's part of what we're trying to train for, because when a police officer or even a civilian employee, because we have dispatchers, we have folks that work in our victims assistance unit, civilians as well. So employees from both sides of the line, whether law enforcement or civilian, frequently talk to people that have been heavily traumatized. So what we're trying to do is be able to, A, recognize that the person is showing some signs of stress or trauma, and then, B, putting them in a position to seek resources. But typically, you can see employees that are performing extremely well, have a change of demeanor or personality, or the performance changes. There are certain things that are red flags, so to speak. And if you have someone that day in, day out has had a specific personality, and then you start to see some changes, that's a red flag.
Yeah, what are some of those red flags?
Well, example, you may have a stellar employee that comes to work every day on time, does everything correctly. Now they're not coming to work on time. They're taking a lot of sick time. Mm. When they're at work, that positive example they were trying to give, and that
that's some of the red flags.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because if you're coming in every day and doing a good job, and it may not be what's causing it, but it's one of the things that may make us look at, hey, is there anything going on? And we're training our employees to be able to, with respect, approach folks and say, hey, is there anything I can do to help you? Because the peer-to-peer and the secondary trauma, there's some formal pieces to it, but there's also some informal parts as well.
So, you know, what you guys recognize in some of the things that is happening in the police department, when you recognize this, what are some of the other things that you're putting in place by having conferences or what?
Well, Chief Daryl Forte has made it very clear that he wants to take care of our police officers from the inside out. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is we have to take care of ourselves first. So mm-hmm. The first part, Melvin, that's most important, is from the top down, we've recognized this is important. And the second part that I think is critical for us that we've done is we've put it out there and let police officers know that we are working on this, and it's nothing you have to run from or hide from. We recognize these things happen. We know that in the past there have been times there's been a little bit of stigma attached to it. If you felt like you were traumatized or stressed, mm-hmm. we'd like to hide that because we want to keep our jobs. And now we're recognizing, not just on KCPD, but across the country, law enforcement and emergency services are recognizing, hey, you can't do these kind of jobs, be an ER nurse, be a police officer, firefighter, right. EMT.
Take special people to be able to do that.
You do. And, yeah. and the thing is, you're going to see some things that cause stress.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not burying our head in the sand and going, oh, let's just keep pushing through, because that doesn't always work. We're recognizing that folks, completely normal people, are going to get stressed out and have problems. So we're trying to put mechanisms in place and make sure that our employees know there are resources, number one. And number two, we're not going to make major drama about this. We mm-hmm. want them to understand it's a support mechanism. We're not trying
to hunt.
Yeah, we're not picking on you.
Yeah.
We're trying to support you. A mm-hmm. completely different philosophy. We don't want you to hide it. If you have a problem, we want people to be comfortable enough to say, hey, look, I need some help.
Are you experiencing suicide in the ranks of the police department?
All law enforcement agencies and all emergency service components have suicides. It's suicides exist in every walk of life.
Mm.
We do have a higher rate in law enforcement, and we have experienced that.
Mm. So how do you spot that? You know, like I guess what you said, you know, if a person is stellar, coming to work on a regular basis, and then all of a sudden he changes his behavior, and that is a red flag, do you go in immediately and pull the person off the line and start talking to them?
No, and I'll be honest with you. I would say it's a case-by-case basis,
mm-hmm.
And it depends on the working environment and the unit. KCPD is a pretty big law enforcement agency,
mm-hmm.
so it's not unheard of for me to work in an assignment and be there for years and never see you if you work for us. I can mm-hmm. go years and years and never see people I went to the police academy with. We're trying to train all units and all elements in this. It's going to take a while to get the information out. But the goal, Melvin, is to make sure that our entire agency is trained and understands, because if I'm working in homicide and you work in traffic, I may never see you.
That's right.
But what I want is across the board to have people trained in all elements and all units so that we do have the ability to provide the resources.
Now, is there a place, like, for instance, if the officer spots his partner and he's not functioning properly, is there a place that he goes to make someone else aware of this?
We've got a pretty specific set of policies that we adhere to.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain activities, if you see an officer do, that you're mandated to report. But if you see something as simple as, hey, today Melvin's acting extremely agitated, he seems to be out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're trying to train on, because that's a little bit trickier to find that. Because if I see that you're acting unusual, you may not be doing anything that's not a policy violation. But I know Melvin's usually a pretty even-tempered guy, and today he's really agitated. We're trying to teach and train people to recognize that and then be able to address it, even if it's informal, by saying, hey, let's break loose. Let's get a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a little bit of time to decompress, because sometimes that's all is required. If I make mm-hmm. 8 calls in a row and there's 40 calls holding, waiting to be answered, I might need 20 minutes to grab a cup of coffee, use the restroom, and calm down a little bit, because the last 7 calls might have put me in such a heightened state of anxiety. Because if you make a shooting call and then you make a vehicular where somebody's been really injured and then you make a call where somebody's had been burglarized. Every time you go to a call, we don't show up on calls where there people are having a party. We show up on calls where there's extreme distress. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, Melvin, for a fact, as I was in patrol a very long time, that carries over day to day, month to month, year to year.
So how did you get involved in this particular field?
I got it. I'm glad you asked me that, and I don't want to elaborate too far about this because it's personal. But I get kind of enthused when I talk about it. But I have an autistic son, and we had a lot of trauma and stressors at my house because of my autistic son. I had a schizophrenic dad who liked to roam off. He had a lot of tendencies to violence. So first it was embarrassing to me because the police were going to my dad's house. And I noticed that my performance started to fall off because I was stressed about my father and my son. My boy's almost 12, and I've got a lot of support mechanisms in place. But I really struggled for a while. And I said, man, I've got to get involved with some folks here on the PD, and that's how I got started. We had a crisis intervention team, and I became very active. I've met a lot of police officers in the same shape that I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of things that stress us, not just having a child that's got autism or having a schizophrenic father. Sometimes you're getting a divorce. Sometimes you've just had a bad day. But, you know, we're just trying to put things in place to help folks like myself and the other 1,800 employees that we have.
Is there a office, say, for instance, if an officer just getting ready to go out in the field and he decides that he's under a lot of stress, and could he just walk into an office and say, talk to you?
No, there's not. And that's what we're working on. That's why we're creating the secondary trauma and the peer-to-peer. He could walk in his sergeant's office, his captain's office, his major's office. But the likelihood of that officer doing that, I don't know if that's going to happen.
Mm.
So we're trying to formally create some things here that let, just what you said, create that option to, hey, if you need to call somebody. Now, we've got a lot of formal things in place, like our EAP program for employee assistance. We've got chaplains. We've got venues and routes that officers can take, but they don't always use them. And we may need to take more time in letting employees know that those are available.
That's interesting. One of the biggest things that I'm thinking that, you know, let's say, for instance, a guy is at that breaking point and mm-hmm. he's about ready to go out in the field. And I was just wondering, how would you guys handle that? And he's coming in and talking to the sergeant or the captain, yourself, and what would you do?
If a supervisor or a commander feels that that employee is not capable of going to work that day, they can put them on a sick day. They can put them on some type of day off. And we've done that. We've recognized that today this employee doesn't need to be here because they're not going to be able to do a good job. They may be too stressed out. They may have something going on in their personal life that's not going to really allow them to go out and do their job today and serve the community in the way that we want them to. So we can unplug them for that day. That takes some individual recognition on the part of the sergeant or the commander.
And I noticed that you are involved with the people that are having PTSD.
Correct.
And how do you recognize that, and how do you point that out, and what's in place?
Okay. Sometimes those folks come to us. We'll have folks that are suffering from some stress from our job, or maybe they're coming back from the military. And where I'm at in human resources, we have lots of programs available. They may or may not seek us out. But again, we're trying to train our officers to recognize when they see that, because I'm going to be honest, police officers don't like to come forward and tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't.
Yeah.
They're not going to come
and
say,
macho thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, in law enforcement folks, whether it's male or female, I'm telling mm-hmm. you, we believe in fixing our own problems.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, sometimes we suffer because of that, because we're not really good at asking for help.
Mm-hmm. You know, I noticed that the police force, they hire a lot of guys coming in out from the Army or
Correct.
From the military, I
yes.
should say. And a lot of those guys have been on the battlefield, and mm-hmm. they want to go into law enforcement.
Right.
And how do you deal with that employment, recognizing some of those guys are coming from stress situations?
Well, not only do we recognize they're coming from stress, sometimes they go back because
mm-hmm.
they're still in the military reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a program in place that allows them to come back and decompress and get their lives in order so they can come back to work for us.
Mm-hmm.
We have a new program with the PD, and this is very exciting. It's called Save a Warrior. And it allows officers that are hitting that high stress level to go to this program And this is a national program, but only two agencies right now, LAPD and KCPD, are the only two agencies using it. LAPD sent about 50 guys so far, and we're just starting to send police officers here, so we're the second city. But Save a Warrior is a week-long program that allows a person, whether it's military or law enforcement, who is experiencing extreme stress, to go for a week and work on some tools to help them deal with their stress.
Is that something that you make sure that they talk about, even when you say that a lot of guys like to fix their problems themselves? Is that something that you know that this particular guy has come from the military, and you make sure that he goes into one of those things that are in place, one of the programs you're talking about?
It's a good point, question you're asking. You have to opt in. You have to say, hey, I want to go, because we're not making anybody go to Save a Warrior. Now, we will let them know it's available. And it's the same thing when if we become aware the person needs some help, we make these programs available. There is a point in time where if an employee's performance is so, if there are problems, where we will step in and say, hey, we need you to do this. We're not asking you to do this. Here are the actions that need to be taken. And we unplug employees from time to time and get them the services that they need. A lot of the stuff that we're offering is, you know, you've got to opt in. You've got to choose to use these services.
Yeah, because I was just thinking about, you know, rather than wait for them to step up to the plate, you know, just having something in place to make sure, because this guy is just coming out of say Iraq or one of the places overseas, and seem like as soon as he walks in the door and want a job, seem like that would be the first thing that your offices should, you know, point out to them about going through this class.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the other thing we have, when a person, let's say they're trying to be a new hire, we've got an extensive background that we do. We've got an extensive polygraph that we do. We've got an extensive psychological that we do to try to see if they're coming on board with any issues. And once they get here with us, we've got a lot of systems in place so that if we recognize an employee is having issues, we can steer them into seeking the assistance that they need, whether it be psychological. There's a lot of systems in place, and it's not all designed around officers that are traumatized. We've got chaplains. We've got a system. We've trained our employees to assist. And right now, with the 40 or 50 young people that we've trained, we're getting ready to put on a four-hour class. And again, it's voluntary, but you go to our police academy and you spend 4 hours with our trainers learning about the tools and the resources that we have to offer.
So what if a person wants to come on the police department and he recognizes that he does have PTSD, but he has it under control? And would you hire that individual, or what would you do?
Well, now you're getting into the process now on hiring. Mm-hmm. And to get through our process, you have to get through, again, the polygraph, the background, and the psychological. So you're getting into an area that's going to be a little bit more specific. Mm-hmm. And the psychological is a very specific tool we use to ensure that all of our employees are able to get out there and perform and do what they need to do. So that we're not going to bring somebody to work on the law enforcement side that we don't feel at this time is ready to get out there and serve the community.
Sure. Let's say, for instance, if a person that's listening to the broadcast right now and he's interested in going into law enforcement, how would he get in touch with you, for instance?
Well, that part's actually pretty simple. They go to kcmo.org, there's quite a few links on there. But once they get on the link with KCPD, there's employment opportunities. And I want you to make it clear, too, we've got a lot of jobs, not just police officers.
Okay.
We've got civilian employees. My wife is a civilian law enforcement employee. She's a police dispatcher. But there's everything from folks that work inside building maintenance all the way up to management jobs. We have chemists working for us, and once you get on the law enforcement side, we don't just have police officers riding around in police cars. We've got police officers that fly helicopters. We've got police officers in investigations. We've got police officers that are in tactical operations. We've got anything you can think of. So we have a lot of jobs, and we encourage people to come forward. But, again, I always want to make it clear, we have more than just law enforcement. We also have civilian jobs.
I know a few days ago when we talked on the phone that you was telling me that you were in this particular class and you was addressing this with other officers, I think. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, right now we're working on, with our crisis intervention team and our secondary trauma, We've trained about 40 employees, both law enforcement and civilian, and we've spent probably 60, 70 hours in training. Mm-hmm. And we've done a lot of teaching, and now the officers have been taught to teach themselves. So when we get inside this class, it's interesting, some of the stories that you hear from the police employees, because you hear things that a lot of officers aren't comfortable talking about. And when they start talking about their personal lives and how hard it is to come to work some days and do a good job because the kid is sick or your father just died or you just got a divorce, and then you're still expected to come in and work 10 hours out there on the streets and get your job done. I don't want to say like a robot, but, you know, you can't bring your emotions from your personal life and then you're making a call on a traffic accident and then spill your personal life out on the person that just got in a vehicular. And, you know, it's the same thing here being on the job. And we've talked about it a few minutes ago. If you made six calls and they were all heavy trauma calls, you can't carry that to the seventh call. And that's what we're talking about in class. And the stories that I hear from the young police officers are amazing about how much stress they carry and how they deal with it. Sometimes they don't deal with it.
What are some of the things that they have come to you about and from a personal without breaking the anonymity?
Well, police officers will come to you and talk about their personal lives. Say, I'm going through a divorce. I've got a sick kid. We've had officers whose children have been very ill. We've had officers who have made calls, and they'll come to me and say, hey, look, I just made this call. I'm really hurting right now.
Yeah.
And it's not unusual for guys to call me and say, hey, can we go get a cup of coffee and talk 20 minutes? And I had a call last week, and one of my best friends, he said, hey, man, I worked three dead bodies, just natural causes, in 2 days. And he said, man, just took the wind out of me. You got time for a cup of coffee. Just want to sit and chat. And, you know, the thing that he told me was, look, this one was a very young couple. And he died. She woke up, and he had died. And he had some type of medical illness that had been unidentified. And he said, man, he goes, I'm really hurting over this. And, you know, the guy's been on almost 25 years. He's seen a lot of this, but it still hurts.
Yeah. That's interesting, too, because of the fact that people was thinking the police department was superhumans. You know, some people think that.
Yeah, and that's furthest from the truth.
Yeah.
You've got a bunch of humans that want to help.
Yeah.
But I can honestly tell you we're no different than anybody else.
That's right. So, you know, the police officers are human as well.
And
so a lot of times people see the uniform, the badge, and these are perfect people, you know.
You make a good point. And one thing that I want to make sure that folks understand, when a police officer shows up at your door, we don't want you to see us that way. We want you to see us as human beings that are trying to do a job. We want to help you. We're not always on our best behavior, and I'm not going to lie about that. A lot of times we are stressed. A lot of times we're tired, and a lot of times we show up and we're not put our best foot forward. We want to, and that's part of what this program is about. We want our officers to be in a position where they can do a good job all day, every day. That's not humanly possible, but that's what we're shooting for.
Yeah, taking one of the cases and one of the things, the big deal that was in the news about, you know, the guy say, I can't breathe. Would you maybe spot some of those officers that may have went overboard and might have been dealing with some stuff that they, you know, in this traumatic experience that they have had, maybe even dealing with some PTSD? Do you ever spot any of that kind of a thing when police officers go overboard?
You do spot officers where you see the officers are starting to become a little bit desensitized. And that's when it is our goal and our job, not just of this program, but every police officer, whether it's a brand new employee to guys that have been here 30 years. Mm-hmm. When I say guys, I mean employees, male or female. But one of the things that we're hoping for is that if you see an officer that is starting to become a little bit desensitized and not understanding that, hey, maybe I went overboard this time. And when I say overboard, it could be as simple as putting a pair of handcuffs on somebody. When you put a pair of handcuffs on someone, just like you saw in that situation, there's a way to do it and there's a way to not do it. And when someone's saying, I can't breathe, we hear that every time we put the cuffs on. But you still have to take that seriously every single time, because every time you slap a pair of cuffs on somebody, oh, it hurts. I can't breathe. You hurt me. You can't be desensitized to that. You still have to listen to it.
Yeah, because the person is human just like the police officer.
Absolutely. And the thing that we're shooting for, Melvin, is that all our officers have the courage to say, hey, man, I need you to step back for a minute, because that's hard to do. It's hard for me to step up and tell another police officer, hey, let's step back for a second. But you got to have the courage to do that, and you've got to be in a work environment where you can do that.
Okay. We're just about running out of time. We got about a minute. Is there anything that you would like to address and let the audience know about what the police department is doing and being sensitive to what's going on in their ranks?
Well, the only thing I would say in closing is that we take it seriously, our job. We believe in what we do. Mm-hmm. We're here to serve the community. We're here to take care of the community, but we're also here to take care of each other. And if we can't take care of each other, we can't do the other part. So taking care of one another is a big step to being able to serve and take care of the community.
Thank you, Captain Brad Deisler.
You're welcome.
I appreciate you coming into the studio and being my guest.
You're welcome.
Now, the calendar for March 2nd, 2015. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, March 2nd, from 6:45 p.m. to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, KCMO. They will be planning their next steps for keeping Senate Bill 189 moving through the Missouri legislature. They ask you to bring a friend and some non-perishable food items for the weekend backpack program for needy children. For information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob, that's R-E-D-R-O-B, 2655 at yahoo.com. KC moved to amend, the Economics Club of UMKC, and the Mainstream Coalition are hosting a screening of the film Pay to Play. The LA Times says Pay to Play lays out a compelling case against corporate personhood and money as free speech. Researched, sourced, and interviewed exhaustively. This screening will be held Thursday, March 5th, 7 p.m. at the UMKC Student Union Theater, 5100 Cherry Street, KCMO. This event is open to the public. To contact KC Move to Amend about this event, call 816-885-9996 or email kcmovetoamend@gmail.com. You can also find them on Facebook and Twitter. The Kansas City chapter of Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum will be Friday, March 6th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, KCMO. The guest will be Deputy Chief Randall Hundley of the KC Police Department. He will speak on urban policing in an age of racial unrest, diminished mental health resources, non-existent gun laws, and how to keep the peace while preserving civil rights. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Up next is Richard Tripp and his guest, Pastor Ron Brook.
Good morning, Kansas City. This is Richard Tripp, Care of Poor People. In America today, poverty, you have many ways of fighting it. I personally, I'm an activist. That's my way of taking care of the homeless. But today we have a gentleman here that does it from the inside. Reverend Ron Brooks, he used to be the minister of the Grand Avenue Temple here for how many years, Mr.?
I was pastor there for 10 years.
10 years. Whoa. That's a long time. But you did it on that side, and I do it on another. But that's cool.
We did it together.
It takes it all. It takes all to change the problems that the homeless face. Speaking of training, where did you get your pastoral training?
You know, Richard, I think it started in my boyhood home. My dad was a pastor, and he was a great role model. And I think I began seeing what a pastor does while I was small. And then it continued, and formally then it began at St. Paul School of Theology right here in Kansas City. And I transferred from there out to Los Angeles and graduated with a doctorate in pastoral care and counseling from the School of Theology at Claremont. But you know, it didn't stop there because I became a chaplain in the Navy. And a lot of my training for later years occurred while I was an officer there. One of the things about my denomination, which is the United Methodist, is they never restricted me as a chaplain or a pastor with church laws and rules about who I could help and who I couldn't help. And the troops always welcomed me because they knew that I was free to roll up my sleeves and get my hands dirty and work with them wherever they were, facing whatever issues their lives had. I wasn't barred from dealing with homosexuals or from working with people who had been divorced, remarrying them. I could serve the Eucharist to anyone who had a faith in Jesus Christ. So it was great, the commander said, to have a chaplain that was able to fit into almost any circumstance that was needing help.
Where did you have a congregation before you came to Kansas City?
Well, while I was in Los Angeles, I was on the staff of a church on Wilshire Boulevard there, right between Santa Monica and L.A. downtown, and I was there for 5 years. Then I came to Missouri, and I haven't left. Although I spent most of my time in the metropolitan area of Kansas City, I spent 4 years in Springfield. I have also done a lot of other things besides pastoring as a parish pastor. You know, when you say pastor, I think it means you're a parish associate. And I've been a chaplain. I'm a board-certified chaplain with the Association of Professional Chaplains when I was at Kingswood, a retirement center in South Kansas City. And I was there for 10 years as well. But I have to say that was different kind of ministry than a parish pastor. So I have been ministering, and I'm still ministering, even though I'm not a parish pastor any longer. It's one of those things you never quit doing. If you're called by God to serve, you do that even after you retire. You just don't quit.
Well, tell me, Reverend Ron, you've been all over dealing with the homeless. Do you see a difference in the needs of the poor and homeless here in Kansas City from other places you've been?
Not really. I think poor is poor wherever it is, and being marginalized and excluded happens wherever there are poor people. And so I think the big difference maybe here in Kansas City is the generosity of the population. The people here really care and want to help. I was always amazed how generous people were who came to volunteer with Lazarus Ministries and who donated to Lazarus Ministries. It was heartwarming to see that. And it wasn't just during the holidays, which is when you usually see most
Some
of that.
Some people might not know about Lazarus Ministries. Would you say a little bit about them?
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm still involved with Lazarus. It is a 501c3, a nonprofit corporation, and it has five different ministries. One of them is meals. Meals used to be hard to find in the city, but now there's plenty of food. There's no reason to be hungry in Kansas City because there's food a lot of places. But that was our first ministry, and then we started a clothing store. We call it Lazarus Boutique. And it's we usually run 80 to 100 people through it every week with the help of volunteers from different groups, congregations of different faiths. And the third thing we do is a medical clinic that is run by the UMKC School of Medicine. It has people from the School of Pharmacy in it, too. And most recently, it started a dental clinic. One time this month, and then it'll be continuing. We also have a overnight shelter, emergency shelter for women, with a capacity of 20 people in it. That's open only during the winter months, only during 4 months of the winter, starting with December 1 and closing April 1. Then the fifth thing that's really kind of unique but very special is a library. We have library shelves around the room where people stand in line to be served their meal. And a lot of people don't have money to go to the movie, and a lot of them who stay in the shelters don't like the one show that's on the TV, so reading is a popular pastime for a lot of homeless people. And so we get books from all over. Johnson County Public Libraries is one of the best sources. They give us what they have left after their book sale a couple times a year.
Where do you get your clothing?
We get clothes from all across the state. There's a group in northwest Missouri that brings them down. We have a volunteer group that comes once a month from Horton, Kansas, a couple hours, maybe 2.5 hours out west of us, and they bring in clothes. We get clothes from the Church of the Resurrection in Leawood. They're a regular delivery for us, and we get them from some good places and some bad places, but we sort them all and find ways to use them.
Since you left Grand Avenue Temple, do you look at problems in the city differently than what you look like as pastor there serving?
My perspective is different now, and it really changed more, I guess, as I started, because when I started, I was thinking that everybody wanted to solve their problems. And then I discovered that not everybody wanted to solve their problems. A lot of people wanted me to solve their problems instead of taking responsibility for themselves. So that was one of the first things I discovered, and figuring out how to identify the people that really wanted to solve their problems and work with them to enable them to do that was one of the first things I learned about working with the homeless. Not everybody's ready, you know. Not everybody wants to solve their problems. Some are satisfied with a lifestyle that they've acquired over the years or an attitude that they've developed, and they really aren't interested in change. The really neat thing, though, is to see those people come around to a point where they really want to do something about their issues and be there then to work with them when they get ready to do something about it. But now that I'm retired, which is really more to the point of your question, I'm looking at it as a way for me to enable others who are now volunteering on the front lines the way I did for 10 years to get the same buzz from helping others, from service. Because as I listen to them talk, I feel the same excitement and satisfaction that I felt for 10 years while they were on the front lines serving or the meal or handing out the clothes. So my perspective has changed a lot since I retired, but I'm enjoying watching other people enjoy what they do the way I did, because I got a real kick out of my work with the people through Lazarus Ministries for 10 years. It was awesome.
Well, and instead of being a student, now you're a teacher.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Hopefully I'm helping others see the way to be helpful to people without taking over their lives, you know, enabling others. I had a guy text me yesterday, I think it was, who had volunteered Saturday in the boutique. And he said, you know, my daughter has just been admitted to an exclusive graduate school, and I'm so thankful. And gratitude is action. And I'm so grateful that I was glad to be able to serve others in the boutique Saturday, because I had a lot of gratitude in my heart. And I think gratitude is simply serving others. And so he was there serving, and I felt the joy he had by being able to be helpful to other people, because he was so full of the thanksgiving for what had happened in his own family life.
Here in our community, you know, what do you think or see is the biggest problem that the homeless face in our community from what you've seen?
I think the main issue the homeless face is a misperception, a misunderstanding of who they are, which creates barriers between them and the general public. There is a misunderstanding or an illusion that all homeless people are addicts, substance abusers, or all of them are mentally ill. And that's just not true. There are a lot of people who are homeless because of things that happen beyond their control. They're not all responsible for the decisions that got them there. There are lots of decisions being made in our lives that we don't have any control over. So one of the nice things about our Lazarus Ministries is that we bring volunteers in to have face-to-face involvement with the homeless, and they can break down those stereotypes right there on the spot and get to know somebody for a few minutes and see that they are like anybody else. They just have more issues and fewer resources maybe to deal with them.
If somebody would like to get together with Lazarus Ministries, where would they call, or do you have a website or anything like that?
Yes, we do have a website that is Lazarus Ministries at Grand Avenue Temple UMC.org. And then we have a office phone that's 816-842-3484 for people who want to call in and begin to get connected with our volunteer program.
What do you think about housing in Kansas City for the poor? Do you think it's a big issue? How could we change things?
It has been and still is a big issue, and we've made some major strides in the last few years about that because of the homeless task force that's been convened that's really dealing with homelessness as a regional issue, not just a Kansas City issue, because it goes way beyond the city limits of Kansas City. And one of the things that's been most helpful is being able to coordinate different agencies. There are a lot of agencies that are providing all kinds of services to the homeless, but they're all working sort of in their own world. And part of the task this homeless task force has faced has been to try to coordinate those different organizations and help them get over some of the turf issues, you know, and be more cooperative and just figure out systems that can streamline and make it easier instead of more difficult for people to get through it.
Well, I know from dealing with the homeless, you know, I run Care of Poor People, which is a 501c3. And one of the things, when I started, there was nobody doing what I do, which was a couple events a year, making sure people survived on the street, feeding them, party-type atmosphere. Today, there's probably 300 groups out there doing the same thing that I did back then. And you know what? I'm not needed there. I did what I was supposed to do. And now all these groups, because of what I did, what I showed people, they're doing it now. So now I've got to find me a new job. You know, I got to take it in a different direction. Care of Poor People at one time was just feeding and clothing the homeless. Now we're going to go a new direction. I'm in the middle of putting together a homeless newspaper in Kansas City. Now, we've had one probably 30 years ago. There was one that was here for like 2 weeks, and then it quit. Other major cities has got these homeless newspapers where the homeless can make money, but Kansas City has not done it, and I'm determined to do that now. That's going to be my new job. And I know God tells you like he tells me, hey, you're done it the old way. It's time to get out there and forge something new.
We're both looking for new roles, aren't we? But we're not quitting.
No, we don't quit. You can't. God won't let you get involved and quit.
That's right.
He will not
That's
let
right.
you do it.
There's a new job for you, Richard. There's a new job for me, and I'm finding mine, and I know you'll find yours.
Well, I'm sure I will, but, you know, just think about it, people. This man was next to some of the poorest people in town for 10 years, giving them service. Most of them knows him by his first name. You know, that's a heck of a lot of love going out.
You know, I want to clarify one of the words that we use about the homeless. You know, that is a divisive, demeaning kind of term. And we like to be more inclusive at Lazarus. So instead of talking about street people or homeless people, we use the word sojourners. S-O-J-O-U-R-N-E-R. Sojourner means somebody who's on a journey, somebody who's on a way to a new place. And that comes out of the Hebrew scriptures in the Bible, where Moses led the people of Israel out of bondage and out of captivity into a new land, into a new life. And that's what we think we are doing. So we want to be inclusive. Actually, using that word puts us all in the same boat because we're all on a journey someplace, you know. It may be geographical or maybe spiritual, but each one of us, you and me as well, Richard, are on a journey someplace, and we need help to get there. And so Lazarus's mission is to work with people who are on a journey to find their home, to find a new place of safety and comfort. And so we use that word, and I want to make sure that gets into our talk today because that's inclusive, you know, and we seek to be inclusive rather than divisive in looking at people. I remember my wife was standing on a street sidewalk one day talking to one of the sojourners, and someone came by and spoke to my wife but didn't even look at the sojourner. And as that person left, tears came to the eyes of the sojourner who said, you know, they never see us. They never see us. And I think what we've been doing is trying to make them more visible, trying to make the sojourners more visible by breaking down the barriers that exist between the volunteers and the sojourners so that they can realize that we're all in the same boat and we're all trying to find love in this world and we're all trying to find a sense of peace and security. And so we offer that to them through what we do together.
Well, I got one big question, a really big one.
Okay.
Where are we going to find Pastor Ron a year from now?
Good chance he'll still be here.
Uh-huh.
If the Lord wills. This is home, and I've been in and out of Kansas City a number of times because I've been with the Navy and I've done some traveling around the world. But this is where my roots are and where my love is, and I like Kansas City. It's a great place to live, great place to serve God, and the people here are by far the best.
Well, I know you're still around, but is there a time, like late at night, that you might think, hey, I wish I was back at Grand Avenue dealing with the problems?
Not really.
Okay.
I did ministry every weekend for 48 years, and I don't miss that at all. I did that long enough, I think, and I'm now able to be more intentional about my schedule and about what I'm doing. I do miss the priestly function of serving communion and of being the bridge. That's the word. Priest means bridge. Being the bridge between people and God. And when people come to the pastor of a congregation, they are looking for a means of connecting with God and being closer to God. And the pastor has that opportunity. I miss that. I'm not the pastor anymore, and that's very important to be clear about. I am still in ministry. I'm still serving God. And like you said earlier, that'll never stop. But I am not the pastor, so I miss that. But I'm working on some special projects. We have two groups from Minnesota coming to work with Lazarus this summer, and they're not connected. I'm not sure how that happened. They're coming in different months during the summer, but we're working to develop some kind of advocacy program, a curriculum that we can prepare them for their experience here so that there's more than just sweat that occurs while they're here with us. There's a little learning that occurs so that they will be able to return home afterwards, changed people, with an understanding of urban poverty that will enable them to be effective in dealing with the poverty in their place because it's everywhere. It's not just in Kansas City and it's not just downtown.
Well, you know, real fast, you spoke about St. Paul's School of Theology where you went to training that. I remember when I first came to Grand Avenue Temple, I was homeless or a sojourner, and I ended up living in the church for a year. I lived in the basement down there. And I don't know if you remember Stuart Whitney, which was
Ah, yes. He's still with us in spirit.
In spirit. But I was sitting down there a couple weeks after I was there, and he told me, walks up to me, and he says, Tripp, we got 100 students coming from St. Paul's Theology, or Theology, and Mr. Tripp, you get to tell them about this place. Now, I'd never spoke to anybody in my life, you know, and I said, but Stuart, I don't know nothing about speaking to people. He said, I didn't ask you what you know. Get downstairs, get up on that pulpit and talk to them. So about an hour later, I'm there looking out at him, and I just froze, you know. But one of the things I did.
You were at a loss for words?
Yes.
No lie.
One of the things
I don't believe it.
At the church was put sandwiches away. And this Jewish gentleman and his son would bring the sandwiches down every day, and that's what we was feeding them at nighttime. Anyway, I'm putting them away, and this little 5-year-old Jewish boy walks up to me, and he hands me a sack, a paper sack. And he said, this is for the homeless. I just stuck it in my pocket, didn't think nothing else about it. But an hour later, I get up around that pedestal on the stage down at Grand Avenue Temple, and I look out at these 100 students, and like I said, I froze. I didn't know what to say. But I remembered that sack in my pocket, and I pulled that sack out, and I looked in that sack. What that little 5-year-old Jewish boy had given me was his piggy bank. Now, if a 5-year-old kid can give you their piggy bank for the poor and homeless down there, how much more should I have been doing than just looking out for Richard Tripp?
Wow. He got your attention, didn't he?
And has had it for the last...
Well, you know, the Jewish population are still with us, serving others. I'm happy to say we have a Jewish congregation coming this weekend to work with Lazarus, and we are always... grateful for their interest and their involvement. They bring their confirmation class every year to be a part of what we're doing and to make sure that they understand things from a Christian point of view as well as their own.
Well, Reverend Ron, thank you so much for coming in for the interview today. Hope I did you justice.
I've enjoyed talking with you, Richard. I always do, though, whether it's on the radio or not.
Okay. Thank you.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
All right, we're here in San Francisco, California, second day of the International Cannabis Business Conference. I'm here in the atrium with Mr. Steve D'Angelo. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Dean. Nice to be here with you again.
Yes, sir. You've been director of the Harborside Health Center for many years now and doing a little battle with the government from time to time, but you still got the doors open and doing strong, aren't you, sir?
Oh, yeah. We're going to be here for many years yet to come.
Now, I was really surprised and happy to see they were handing out brochures downstairs in the ballroom, and lo and behold, they handed me one that says The Cannabis Manifesto, A New Paradigm for Wellness, and it's written by Mr. Steve D'Angelo. Tell us what's in that book, Steve.
So The Cannabis Manifesto is 8 chapters. Each one is a statement of belief, starting with cannabis isn't harmful, but prohibition is. Then we move on with 7 other core foundational arguments about cannabis. And I back those arguments up with history, science, political analysis, and personal anecdote. So my personal story is sort of woven throughout the arguments of the book.
Steve, in my work, I try to get, you know, top government officials to come on my show to clarify the need for drug war, to explain why this is all so necessary. And lately they've been really recalcitrant, running like frightened rabbits, because there is no real defense to what they're up to, is there, Steve?
No, it's totally clear if you just look at the statistics that the drug war has been a disaster. It's caused far more harm than any possible good that could come of it. Upwards of 80% of the arrests in the drug war actually have been for cannabis, not for cocaine, heroin, meth, or other dangerous drugs. So the drug war has mainly been a war on cannabis.
Yeah, and Steve, over the years, I've heard 1 trillion. I've heard, I think it was Judge James P. Gray said $2.5 or $3 trillion have been, quote, invested into enforcing these drug laws. And yet, We haven't rid ourselves of drugs at all, have we?
Well, no. In fact, you know, all of the quote-unquote investment into the war on drugs has directly led to the development of some of the most powerful criminal organizations on the planet. They now have basically Prohibition acts as a price support system for the cartels and puts hundreds of billions of dollars into their hands every year. If the U.S. government was really serious about breaking the backs of the cartels, the very first thing that they would do would legalize cannabis, because the cartels get something like 70% of their revenue from cannabis.
More from Steve D'Angelo on the most recent cultural baggage. DeanBeckerDrugTruth.net.
Ready? One, two, three. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer Beth Pike for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musicale.
Myself how to understand, go make myself a better